Thank you for tuning in to another episode of PolitiTalk with Lane Palmer. Today we have another special guest returning, Frank, who you may all remember from literally the beginning of the pandemic last year. Frank, yeah, last time we talked, I think they were telling us COVID was going to be about, you know, like a couple of months kind of thing, you know, just stay home for a bit and it'll be fine. Maybe by the summer we can all go back to normal. We didn't really know how effective masks were at the time. Nobody was really wearing masks.
That's right. No, in fact, I had an appointment with my doctor in March of last year, which was right before everything started happening with the pandemic. And he said to me point blank, you know, these people they're wearing masks. And I'll tell you right now, masks don't work. And then all of a sudden we're all wearing masks. So yes, changes happened very fast.
Yeah. And it's just like that was primary season. And of course, Biden snagged that and won that. And that was something even you were calling back then.
That's right.
So, yeah, what if anything are some things, and we can kind of talk about them point for point as we move forward. But what are some things that either have surprised you about the last year, kind of floored you, made you upset? Like, what? Just describe to me your past year as Frank and what you've seen in the world.
I think the biggest thing that has surprised me, maybe that's not the right word, concerned me, but is how politicized everything became. That as a country, we weren't able to pull together collectively as a whole to fight the pandemic, to do whatever we could to protect ourselves and our neighbors and friends and family against the pandemic. Instead, it became a political issue. Mm-hmm. If you were a Democrat or if you supported Joe Biden, well, then obviously you were pro-mask and pro-social distancing. But if you were a Republican, then you didn't even necessarily accept the fact that the pandemic was real, even though we saw what ended up being hundreds of thousands of people dying from this disease. There were people who had members of their own family die from this and still refused to accept that this was a real thing. Mm-hmm. That was a big surprise to me in the past year, that we made, as a country, everything political. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've been seeing that happen for quite some time, that the environment becomes political, human rights becomes political. It seems that everything becomes political and you have to pick a side. And some of these issues involve all of us and affect all of us. And I would have thought that once we got to something that was such a human tragedy as a virus that could potentially wipe us all out, that maybe we could all be on the same team. But that didn't seem to happen either.
Yeah, it's interesting you make that point, because even I remember growing up in school, like learning about World War II, it seemed like, oh, you know, all hands on deck. And it's like, it would be the equivalent of like a group rising up and like saying that Nazis don't exist. Like,
right.
Like, you're like, what?
Yeah, that would never happen.
So that's so interesting. Yeah. And I think that falls back on, I think sometimes the media, I think that falls back on who we had as a leader at the time. I mean, it just seemed like it was all just a recipe for disaster. How did you navigate COVID personally? Like, were you ever, what moments scared you? What moments concerned you personally?
I think that the moment that scared me the most personally was, interestingly enough, was on election night. Mm-hmm. I started to run a fever on election night. I was all ready to settle down, hopefully to see Joe Biden win. And I started to run a fever, and I had no reason to. I was feeling fine. I had no reason for that to happen. And so there was a period of a couple of days that, because I called and was able to get a COVID test, and there was a couple of days of waiting to find out if I actually had COVID. And for my age, I was like, you know, the older that you are, the worse that it could be. I was concerned. Fortunately, I did not have COVID and it came back negative. But that was a very scary thing for me personally. I think initially when it first started to happen, And so we're talking back in March, and I was actually on spring break from teaching at that point, and that's when everything started to shut down. And there was just this sort of overwhelming sense of hopelessness as you're just starting to see the world sort of close down around you, that it was almost like science fiction. It was it was very frightening to walk out in your neighborhood and just there would be no one. We would take walks because we needed some form of exercise, and so we would take walks, and literally we could walk down the middle of the streets in our neighborhood because there was no fear that cars were going to be coming because nobody was working. And that was just very unsettling. Never in my lifetime had I experienced something like that, where society as a whole just stops and everyone stays home. And so I found that to be somewhat frightening. I never felt necessarily scared for my own health. I mean, there were, as most people, there were things that we just had to do. You have to go to the grocery store. You have to go to the doctor potentially. So there were moments when we had to go out and about, and so I would wear my mask and social distance and do those sorts of things, and lots of hand sanitizer to take care of myself. And I felt pretty comfortable and safe, avoiding crowds. I mean, it was a year before we even thought about going into a restaurant. And I mean, so you just avoided those sort of situations. But yeah, I think that it was more of a challenge for me in terms of what I do, because I'm a college professor and I teach theater, and taking courses that are very intimate and face-to-face and having to translate that to an online format became a real interesting challenge, and having concerns about the education that young people are getting because it's all being done via computer. That I found very challenging over the past year. I'm very happy now that things are starting to move back into the classroom. It's a nice change of pace from what I've been doing for the past year.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to even ask you, like, as an educator, like, even for my job, like, I think my class was the last in-person training class for my department. After that, everything was virtual, and even to this day, it still is. Did you have any training? Was it just kind of, you were just kind of thrown into the wind there? Like, did they ever train you on like what Teams was, what Skype was, what Zoom was? Cause I feel like for a lot of educators, they were just kind of like, okay, we're virtual now. Good luck.
Well, the short answer to that question is no. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was literally no time to train. I mean, this transition happened overnight. As I said, I was on spring break, and over spring break, we were notified that the campus was closing down, and we had 1 week to get back to campus to just gather whatever we needed and send out emails, which is still the primary form of communication to college students from the faculty, send out emails to our students saying, we're going to be doing this virtually from here on out. Fortunately, our college, and I do believe most colleges are this way, we already have a system that that is an online system that students can engage when it comes to their classes, that professors can put up information and videos and those types of things. So that already exists, and the students were aware of that. So for most of us, it was a matter of just engaging that system and using it more than what we had been. Mm. I learned how to, I created, because I do social media, some social media, not a lot of it, but Facebook seems to be a social media platform that most people either have or they can very easily get access to it. And so I had all of my students, if they didn't already, create a Facebook page, and it could be just for the class, that's fine. And then I created private Facebook groups that were for my classes only, so nobody else could see it or get into it. Mm-hmm. The students would then join those, and then they could upload their videos that they did with their own cell phone cameras. I could upload my videos. We could have conversations back and forth. I could even do FaceTime and have actual real-time events on Facebook so that they could actually ask me questions and they could see me. I couldn't see them, but they could see me, and then I could answer their questions in real time as they typed them in. So we found different ways to be able to do that, and then eventually incorporating Zoom and Teams and Collaborate and a few other types of video and communication platforms. So, but yeah, it was on-the-job training. After a year, I'm so much better at this stuff than what I was a year ago, and learning how it works. So, but yeah, we were just on our own to figure out how to make this happen.
Is there anything that was either initially started or implemented more so in the pandemic in terms of, like, you know, just maybe even career, but maybe personally, that you saw that you either want to see continue on after the pandemic, like, you know, continuing to wear masks, or, you know, having the plexiglass up at the grocery store? Like, what are some things that you would like to see continued and implemented into our society moving forward?
Okay. Well, I do think that there are some things that are here to stay. And that is, that seems to be true in any type of a major event. There are things that, you know, 9/11 happened, and now we have everyone has to go through the metal detectors, and you have to have a plane ticket to actually get into the terminal. That wasn't the case before 9/11.
Wow.
You know, your friends and family could walk right up to the terminal with you and watch you fly away as your plane took off. That can't happen anymore. So there, all major events tend to result in changes that then stay with us. I think that I wouldn't be surprised if the plexiglass stays.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, it actually makes sense. I mean, even if COVID would be completely wiped out, which no one seems to think that that's the case, but even if it were, we still have colds, we still have flu, we still have things like that. Why not have a piece of plexiglass up that could protect you and the other person at the checkout line or at the bank or those sorts of things? So I really do think that that will probably stay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is the potential for masks in some situations to stay,
mm-hmm.
maybe especially in medical environments. I mean, people tend to go to the doctor or the hospital because they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't it make sense that they have a mask on while they're there so that they don't make somebody else sick? So part of me thinks that we may see some permanent changes like that. For myself, I've told myself that I think it's a good idea never to shake hands again. Because that's a primary way that we transfer germs is through shaking hands. And it's also something that is relatively unique to the United States. A lot of other countries don't do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, I'm going to try to avoid shaking hands from here on out.
Yeah.
Maybe in certain situations, flying on an airplane or something like that, I might carry a mask with me down the road, just because, you know, there might be times when maybe people are sick or whatever, and it's like, I just want to cover my face and try to avoid getting it.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as other types of things pre-pandemic, I do think that some of the communication platforms that we have been using, as you mentioned, like Zoom and Teams, I think some of those things are here to stay as well. And I'm kind of okay with that. I'm sort of okay with being able to have a meeting over the computer and not have to drive to my office to do it on my day off, because that's the best day for everybody to meet, and or to be able to have a load of laundry in the washing machine while I'm actually at a meeting at the same time. So some of those things, because of convenience, I think will actually stay as well, and we'll be able to trace that back to the pandemic in terms of why is it that, you know, people are doing this. I mean, we can even look at, I mean, a lot of our major news networks, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, not so much CNN, they were, but MSNBC and Fox News really came into being after 9/11, because people were hungry for news and what was going on, and there were those two networks, and some of the reporters who were on those networks were almost became overnight stars because of their wall-to-wall coverage they were having on those networks that people hadn't really paid attention to before. Mm-hmm. Nobody even really knew what MSNBC really was mm-hmm. before 9/11. So major events can actually impact change that then stays with us from here on out.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see people be more cautious, I guess, in terms of like coming into work if they're sick. I mean, I remember even just I had a job maybe about 5 years ago where I remember I had called off because I had had a fever or something, and you know, nothing major, but it was just a fever and I just didn't feel good. So I took the day off, and I remember going into work the next day and one of my older colleagues was like, "I can't believe you called off for just a fever. You know, back in my day, us youngins, we'd always be in here working sick. You know, you take breaks, go to the bathroom, throw up, you come right back, get back to work." And I'm like, "No, that's not okay. We should take time off when we're sick. Like, this is exactly why."
Right. No, and I agree with you. I think that businesses will start reexamining some of those policies or methods. You know, it's funny. This was probably a couple of years ago, but as an example of how things change, I was in class and a student, I forget what they were trying to open, but it was some sort of a bottle or a jar. And you know, you take the top off and then there's also some sort of a plastic thing. There's two or three layers that you have to get through to actually get to the product. And they were complaining about that. And I asked them, I said, "Do you know historically why any of that exists?" Which, of course, they didn't. Why would anyone? But when I was in high school in the 1970s, there was what was referred to as the Tylenol scare. And before the Tylenol scare, you could walk into any grocery store and open any jar, just screw the lid off, and there was the product. So somebody had actually slipped poison into bottles of Tylenol in grocery stores, and people had died. And so as a result of that, packaging changed. That now there has to be, you know, so now if you buy a bottle of Tylenol and you get home, you could tell if it's been tampered with. Mm-hmm. You could, I mean, when I was a kid, you could open a jar of peanut butter and stick your finger in it and take out a bit and then screw the lid back on. I mean, nothing was packaged for protection at that time. So it's because of the Tylenol scare in the late 70s that we now have this abundance of packaging that we have to get through to actually get to the product. So big events like that change. Yeah. You know, it just changes how we live and what we do. And just like the things we've talked about with the pandemic, 20 years from now, there'll be a whole generation of people that will just assume that we always had plexiglass at the cash registers. Mm-hmm. We always wore masks on airplanes because that's the only world they've ever known.
Yeah.
Just like there's a generations of people who assume that you always had to go through three layers to open a jar of peanut butter. It's like,
that's what I thought. Yeah.
No, that's been around for about 40 years, but wasn't always the case.
Wow. I even just working at my job now and taking auto claims, I didn't realize that all cars didn't just used to come with airbags. Like even I was taking a claim for like an 88 the other day, and I'm like, "Oh, did your airbags deploy?" And they're like, "I don't think that car has airbags." And I'm like, "What? What kind of car doesn't have airbags? What are you talking about?"
Well, that's like the rear end collision light, which is the special tail light that's up by your rear window. Mm-hmm. That's only been around since the early to mid 80s. Wow. You know, all cars had before then were just two brake lights. They didn't have that special brake light that was created because people realized that when you're looking at the car in front of you, you're not looking down at its lights. You're actually looking up at eye level, which is through its window, mm-hmm. through its rear window. And so people realized that there needs to be a brake light there. But yeah. I can remember my parents bought a car probably around 84, 85, and it didn't have one of those lights. And my mother saw that newer cars were having those, and so they were able to get their car retrofitted to actually install one of those lights because it was considered safer. Well, now it's standard on every car that you get.
Mm.
But, yeah, there was a time when it wasn't.
Yeah, wow. So another thing that, you know, we had kind of discussed privately before coming on was there was a segment on, for the listeners that don't know, there was a segment on Bill Maher the other day where he was talking about how usually the people more impacted by COVID, you know, age does play a factor, but so does overall health in terms of obesity and things of that nature. And he was talking about how during the pandemic, there should have been more of an emphasis on, you know, eating healthier, finding ways to eat healthier, finding ways to get active at home, exercise more. He argues that as a society, we've become too soft and just, you know, go to body positivity when we should be moving to health positivity. You know, as somebody who is actively always, you know, trying to better themselves and better what they eat and how they exercise, you know, how do you react to somebody who makes a statement like that? How does it connect to you personally?
Well, I mean, you actually didn't know me before I had started taking more interest in my health. And in the last 2 years, I've lost about 55 pounds.
Wow.
And I have wondered over the past year with the pandemic how much that weight loss and paying attention to my nutrition and working out and exercising, how much of that played a part in me being able to stay safe and healthy during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Because it is true. We have noticed that a large percentage of the people who did contract COVID-19 and then did die from it did have other health issues, which did include some issues with the nutrition and obesity and those types of things. So I have wondered, had I been living the life that I was before a couple of years ago, would my outcome have been different when it came to COVID or the possibility of contracting COVID? I do think that I came to it later. I mean, when I was younger, I didn't think about eating healthy or exercising because I was young and I was slim and I was in pretty good shape, and so it didn't matter to me. And then as I started to get older, I was in denial and just, you know, yeah, so I gained 5 pounds last year. Who cares? Didn't really think about it. And it just kind of like hit me all of a sudden that I realized I need to do something. I took one of those tests. If you ever have insurance through your company, usually there's like a health assessment you have to do every year. And you do the whole health assessment and it tells you what your real age is versus how old it thinks you are. And when I started getting these health assessments back, that had me sometimes being 5, 6, 7 years older than what my real age was because they felt that my health had declined that much, I knew that there was something that I needed to do. And so for me, the pandemic almost created an opportunity to be able to even, because it gave me time, to be able to even exercise and work out more. So there was a whole wealth of online workout videos and information, and the gym that I belong to actually did a lot of them. And we were talking about just a minute ago things that we may see continue beyond the pandemic, is that just like my gym, for example, they are continuing to live stream their workouts even though they're also happening in person now as well. That actually provides for more clientele, because some people may not be able to make it to the gym that day, but they can turn it on in their living room and do the workout there. So I think that's something that might actually continue beyond this. But I didn't see the episode with Bill Maher that you were talking about, but I do agree with the idea that if we need to spend less time talking about what a perfect body is or what, you know, what looks good. Because it's really not about looks. It's really, I mean, it shouldn't be. It's about health. And if we can move beyond the vanity, the vain part of the aspect, and actually deal with the fact of, you know, you're eating better, you have better nutrition, you're in better shape physically. And what that's going to do is it's going to help you have a longer, healthier life. Mm. I've learned a lot in the last couple of years when it comes to nutrition and health that I honestly didn't know before. But learning statistics that if you take a walk you know, it's got to be a decent length walk, not just around your house. But if you take a leisurely walk 3 times a week, that puts you in the top 10% of physical exercise that humans do in the United States. That a leisurely walk 3 days a week, and you are in the top 10% of physical activity. That's an amazing statistic to know that that's all it takes to be in the top 10%. So imagine if you're going to the gym 2 or 3 times a week, if you're doing a 30-minute workout here or there, imagine how much further up in that percentage that it puts you in terms of your health. And my own doctor has told me that just the work that I've been doing has added at least 10 years of healthy life to me. Now, that's not 10 years of additional life. That just means that if I am going to live to 80, I've just guaranteed that at least 10 more years of that lifespan is going to be healthy, is going to be physically fit and the ability to do stuff. So, because I think that's one of the worst things, to, you know, live the last 20 or 30 years of your life not being able to really do any of the things you enjoy because you physically just can't. And so just knowing that I've added 10 years of healthy life to my existing time on this planet, I think is great. So I do wish that there was more emphasis placed on the medicinal importance of nutrition and of physical working out, and take less emphasis off the, so you're going to look good and you'll look great in a bathing suit. Who cares about that? It's like, no, you want to be able to live a long, healthy life. We were talking earlier, and there was a book written 2 or 3 years ago called Hillbilly Elegy. And it was written by a person who actually grew up in Southern Ohio. And he was talking about Michelle Obama's nutrition and physical program that she had when they were in the White House, and how, now he's addressing it from, because he grew up as a conservative Republican and was addressing this from the conservative viewpoint in Southern Ohio. But he says in the book that people hated these plans that Michelle Obama had come out with concerning nutrition and concerning health and physicality. But he said they didn't hate it because she told them they should do it. They hated it because they knew she was right. Mm. And that does tend to be the case with most of this, is that when somebody tells us we should eat better, when somebody tells us we should exercise more, we know they're right. I mean, there's nothing out there that says eating better and exercising is detrimental to your health. Mm. No, we know that they are right when they say that. But oftentimes we don't want to hear it. Or oftentimes it's like, no, I know you're right, but I just really want to eat that donut. You know, it's what, you know, so it's finding that balance. It's finding the balance between doing what's good for you and also allowing yourself to have fun and enjoy yourself from time to time as well.
Yeah. So it's currently Pride Month. And kind of just again touching on how you personally evolved into the person you are today. What were some pressures or pressures that you think you might have had in terms of, you know, going through this experience, not only as a man, but as a gay man? Were there any, you know, societal pressures, community pressures that you felt, you know, growing up with this lifestyle and even implementing this new lifestyle?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's always, but you know, there has always been a certain element of the gay community that has always been caught up in looks. Mm. And when I was younger, I was as well, to a certain extent. I don't know that that's necessarily just unique to the gay community. I think in many ways it's kind of unique to just youth in general. I mean, if you think about it, our initial attraction to a human being that we don't know is almost always going to be what they look like. Mm. I mean, and based on what we as a human being find attractive, rarely do we look at somebody and go, oh, wow, I don't know that person, but I bet they're really intelligent. No, we don't. Or I bet they're really funny, or, you know, all these other things that attract us to another human being. our initial reaction is the person and what they look like. And so yeah, there is, I think there's a lot of pressure, gay or not, to become the person that walks into a room that you want to be, where other people look at you, mm-hmm. other people notice you. I think I dealt with that to some extent when I was younger. I've, you know, certainly moved away from it as I've gotten older. And it's funny. I honestly never thought of myself as being an attractive person at all. It just never crossed my mind. I never believed it. I do look back at pictures of myself now when I was in my 20s and early 30s. And it's almost like looking at somebody that's not me, but I'll look at them and go, huh, I actually was pretty good looking when I was younger. I wished I would have known that at the time. It's like, I wished I would have known and believed that and been able to take advantage of the confidence of knowing that I was not a bad looking person, but I didn't believe it. And I'm sure that is not unique to just me. I think there's a lot of people. There was lots of times when I thought that I was just really overweight. And I look at pictures and I'm like, I would love to be that size now. Mm-hmm. And at that time I thought I was, or I thought I was looking really old. And I look at the pictures now and I'm like, I wished I looked that young now. So I don't think that that's unique to just me. I think it's something that a lot of people go through. But in terms of the past year and some of these challenges and things, I mean, I can't really pinpoint something that ties in me as a member of the LGBTQ community and some of the other issues that's going on and making a really strong connection with that.
Mm, okay. Yeah, because I was going to say, that's kind of shocked me. Like, I've seen photos of you as a younger man, and I'm like, Frank, come on. You are gorgeous. Let's go.
Oh, well. well, thanks. I appreciate that. But, I really did. I never believed that. And you know, I think part of that, I can probably even trace back to my junior high and high school years, because I really did not come to terms with my sexuality until I was in college. Mm-hmm. It did not cross my mind when I was in high school that I was gay. I mean, looking back on it, I know that those feelings were there, but I just didn't process it, didn't really know what it was. So what I did know when I was in high school was that I was popular. I had lots of friends who were girls, but no girls wanted to be my girlfriend. Mm. They wanted to be friends with Frank, but they didn't want to date me because they wanted to date the high school quarterback or, you know, one of the athletes. They did, and so there was part of me that interpreted that as me not being attractive. It's like, well, because I wasn't thinking about, well, do any of the guys find me attractive? That wasn't part of my thought process. So if the girls don't want to date me, well, then they don't find, then it must be because they don't like the way I look. So I really think that a lot of it stemmed from that, even though in hindsight, I wasn't really putting out signals that I really wanted to date, you know, because I really wasn't interested in dating the girls because I was gay. I just didn't know that or process that. So I wasn't actively pursuing it, but yet in my mind, because they weren't actively pursuing me, then that must meant that that they didn't like the way I looked.
If you could go back and speak to your younger self at any point in time, what time would you choose and what would you say?
That is a great question. I had told a story a couple of years ago. I had actually spoke at an event that was to recognize the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And part of my presentation was sort of giving a timeline of my life from being a small child up to present day time. And just the many different things that I had personally experienced or seen as since the Stonewall riots in 1969, which I was 8 years old when the Stonewall riots happened. And there's a moment that I talk about in that where I'm in grade school and I hear the word homosexual on TV. it was probably a news program or something. Had no idea what that word meant. But I knew that there was something unusual about the word to the extent that I knew that even at that young age that I needed to hide that I was wanting to find out what that word meant. So we had encyclopedia, we had a dictionary in the house, and my parents were out of the house for some reason. Anyway, they weren't there. And I took that as an opportunity, and there was this bookcase that sat at the end of this hallway with these glass doors. And I opened the glass doors and took out the dictionary and looked up the word homosexual and read what the definition said. And realizing at that moment, although not accepting it, that I felt the way, or I think I'm what that's talking about. But knowing, at least from my upbringing and the religion, all stuff, knowing that that was a really, or feeling that that was a really bad thing. But I can remember that so vividly, and that moment so vividly, that if there could be one moment that I could go back and talk to, it would be going back and talking to that little boy, and after he's done reading that, and letting him know that it's all going to be okay. You're going to be fine. Because I can remember how much that scared me at that moment.
Wow. No, that's really powerful. Yeah, I think even I remember we had talked about, you know, my life growing up and moving constantly. So always being the new kid, you know, you always get the little brunt of a little bullying. And I remember, I think it was fourth grade, I was starting a new school. And I remember somebody had come up to me and was like, "Lane, are you gay? Say yes." And I was like, "Well, wait, I don't know what that word means." Like, they're like, "Well, just say yes. Say yes, you are. It's fine. You don't know what it means." And I was like, "Okay, yeah." And then I remember I went home and I was like, "Hey, some kid at school said I was like gay. What does that mean?" And I remember my mom was like, "That just that. So you know how you have a mommy and a daddy? So being gay just means there's a daddy and a daddy." And I remember I was kind of like, "Oh, well, that doesn't make sense. How do you have a kid?" Like, I was like, I just remember thinking that. That was the first time I'd ever heard of that word or that knew what it meant. So,
well, that, but great for your mother though that she actually tried to explain it as opposed to just saying it doesn't mean anything. Don't ever mention it again.
Yeah, you know, right.
That she actually was like, "Okay, I'll try to explain it to you in a way that you might be able to understand." No, it's funny. I can remember when I was younger as well, and it's funny that. You know, not really knowing that I'm gay, but or not knowing that I was gay at the time. But, you know, you look back on things, it's kind of like, oh, the signs were there from the time I was a very small child. And I always tell this story. I loved when I was a kid and we would, my mother would go shopping on Fridays. Now, this was back in like the 60s. You know, back in those days, women did not leave the house unless they had on high heels and a dress. That was, if you were leaving the house, you always looked nice. You know, you always dressed up. And so we would be in town, my mom would be doing her shopping, and she would walk down the sidewalk and the high heels click on the sidewalk. And I loved the sound of women's heels clicking on the sidewalk and was so upset that my shoes wouldn't do that as well. So I would stand next to my mom, and as she would walk down, I would walk beside her going, making a clicking sound with my tongue because I wanted my shoes to make the same sound as hers. I mean, how gay is that?
Yeah, on the spectrum, I'd say it's about at a 9.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So, you know, there you go. Oh.
Well, Frank, thank you again so much for sharing all your thoughts and all of this. I mean, it's crazy to see how far we've come just as a society and even as friends in the course of a year. I mean, I've visited you, you know, throughout COVID, and you know, we've watched TV shows together and had these chats without recording, and
it's crazy
to think that so much time has passed and yet it's only just been a year. So
I know. Yeah, but a year in time, but almost a lifetime in terms of change.
Yeah, well, thank you again for listening to Polita Talk, and I hope that you guys have a great day.